Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Parshat Vayikra. Rabbi Alex Israel is a faculty member at Pardes and serves as a director of continuing education for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. We're going to talk this week about Parshat Vayikra. We start a new book this week. Our book is going to be far more difficult than the previous two that we've encountered. Whereas Bereshit gives us all the stories, the exciting stories that we know from preschool, all our Bible stories, Adam and Eve and Noah and the Flood and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. Whereas Sefer Shemot gives us the fascinating stories of the Exodus and the Ten Plagues and Mount Sinai and the colorful fabrics and world of the tabernacle. And suddenly Vayikra, third book of the Torah, thrusts us into the world immediately of sacrifices, of korbanot. And it is at this point that we start already beginning to have some difficulties. Because for us, the notion of animal sacrifice is certainly quite foreign from our contemporary reality. For many of us, we find it very, very difficult to even imagine how it could have anything to do with religion. So this is really the question that I would like to deal with today. How can we maybe find some sense in the world of korbanot, in the world of sacrifices? Now, I'm actually going to use the word korbanot rather than sacrifice, and I'm going to do that for a very particular reason. The word sacrifice has interesting connotations. If you talk about having to sacrifice something, it always gives connotations of having to give something up, give something dear, precious to you, that it is somehow being wrought from your hand, it is being taken from you as sort of a heart-wrenching, awful process, and you have to sacrifice something, take it away from yourself. That does not seem to be the appropriate place for korbanot within Judaism. Let's first focus on the word korban. Korban is from the root kufresh bet, karev, karov, which means near. A korban is meant to help you draw near to God. It is not a sacrifice where the primary gesture is one of giving something up. It is not the idea of something being ripped away from you. Rather, the idea, and here I quote Samson Raphael Hirsch's, Rav Hirsch's commentary to the beginning of Vayikra, where he says, Karev means to approach, to come near, and so to get close into a close relationship with somebody. And this is a positive spin on korbanot, the idea that korbanot somehow are meant to attain closeness to God. Now, again, I return to the original question, of course, how can animal sacrifice bring us close to God? What is that? How can we do this? How can we relate to this whole idea? Many people have famously quoted Maimonides in The Guide to the Perplexed, Moreh Nevuchim, where Maimonides talks about the idea that korbanot are actually not something which God prefers. Maimonides there in The Guide to the Perplexed actually says that every culture used the medium of animal sacrifice, of animal offerings to God. So we had to be no different. It's not that God particularly needs us to slaughter animals and bring it, their blood or flesh onto the altar. But that was the mode of worship in those times. And had we been asked to worship in a different manner, it would have simply been bizarre, weird, and nobody would be able to relate to it. It's sort of like if we were asked to relate to God nowadays without prayer, without a prayer house. If we were told that we weren't allowed to have a Bet Knesset, we weren't allowed to do certain rituals that we're used to, and maybe I'd say even more, that every religion does, we wouldn't know where to put ourselves religiously. And therefore there are standard religious gestures which need to be done, and it's a sort of a ritual that is anticipated and expected in relating to God. The Rambam says that Judaism was no different, even though God had no particular desire for korbanot. He allowed us to follow the manner in which contemporary world worshipped God. I've got to be honest that the Rambam came along up to a lot of criticism in this regard. For example, Nachmanides, the Ramban, severely had problems with this approach of the Rambam. And I have to say that I myself also find it rather problematic. After all, let's mention one thing, that the Rambam himself contradicts himself in other places, where Maimonides in other places says, the whole world stands by virtue of the Korbanot. He talks in other places about the wonderful, enduring feature of Korbanot, which will exist even in Messianic times. So it would appear that this isn't something which is going away so quickly. But more than that, the Torah dedicates so much space, so much airtime to the world of Korbanot. I'll say even more than that. When Noah comes out of the ark, he brings sacrifices to God, and it says, and God smelt the sweet-smelling odor of the reach hanichoach of the animals that he had brought, indicating that korbanot are actually something which God does desire in some way, which do actually achieve something in the relationship between man and God. Now, it's true that many of the prophets, again, you can simply turn your attention to Isaiah chapter 1, where Isaiah goes crazy with the people in his time, probably in the time of King Hezekiah, for relying on sacrifices rather than real moral repentance. The people had reached a point where they relied on sacrifices as opposed to everything else. And they had sort of come to a point where they lived incredibly immoral lifestyle, where they were sinning. Again, he says to them, I'll read a little bit of this. He says, reading from chapter 1 of Isaiah, he says, what need have I of your sacrifices, said the Lord? I am sated with burnt offerings of rams, of fatlings, blood of bulls. I have no delight in lambs and he-goats. When you come to me, who asks this of you? You trample my courtyards. Bring no more false offerings. Your incense is offensive to me. And what does he say? He says, when you lift up your hands, I will turn my eyes away from you. Why? When you pray, I will not listen because your hands are stained with blood. He tells the people, wash yourselves, clean yourselves, purify yourselves. Put away your evil doings from my sight. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Devote yourselves to justice. Aid the wrongs. Uphold the cause of the orphan, the widow. In other words, you can't bring a korban and expect it to repair the relationship with God if the relationship with God is in some way broken. Korban is a means of kirva, of closeness to God. And here let me try and explain, I think, the direction that I would like to take regarding korbanot. When we open our Parashat Shavua, there are actually the Parashat Shavua splits into different chapters. The first is an Ola, the Korban Ola, which is a burnt offering. The second is a Mincha. Mincha is a flower offering. The third is called a Shlamim, a peace offering. After that come obligatory sacrifices like a Chatat and Asham, the guilt offering, the sin offering. I'm going to try and talk about these different sacrifices and try and explain what they are. But before I do this, I'd like to give a certain metaphor, which might seem completely off the wall initially, but I hope that it will help explain some of what I'd like to try and talk about with korbanot. I want to talk about flowers. Yes, flowers. Sometimes we want to buy somebody flowers. And why do we want to buy somebody flowers? What I'd like to claim is that even in something as mundane as flowers, there can be an entire language. Let me try and explain what I mean. If, I don't know, President Obama lands in Israel, the President of Israel will probably come to the airport and greet him with a huge bouquet of flowers. And what's he saying if he does that? So if he greets a world leader there, he's saying in some way, I guess we'd say, I salute you, or I welcome you. If I send on Valentine's Day 12 red roses to the person I love, then I'm probably saying, I love you. If I go to somebody for Shabbat and bring them a bunch of flowers because I am receiving their hospitality, then I'm saying, thank you for your hospitality. I imagine that when somebody puts a wreath on the grave of the unknown soldier or some other grave, we're saying again, I honor you. There are, you know, if you take a bunch of flowers to somebody who's sick in hospital, you're saying, get well soon, I care about you. We can have an entire range of emotions which are associated with something as mundane as a flower. Sometimes even different flowers say different things. And the idea is that, first of all, we can ask the question, why do we need flowers? Why can't I just say to my host for Shabbat, thank you? Why can't I just go to the person in the hospital and say, get well soon? Why do we need to give the flowers? What I think I'm trying to demonstrate is that sometimes, in order to express emotions, we need to manifest the sort of ephemeral emotions, the very abstract feelings, on a very tangible, this-worldly object. And by the transferring of an object, by giving this object from hand to hand, we somehow not only we don't only pass the object from hand to hand, but we convey our feelings in a more concrete, forceful, in a more real manner. We've given a certain form and substance to our inner thoughts. But of course, as I said, this symbolic gesture, and it really is only a symbolic gesture, even though, again, we could have lots of rules about, you know, exactly how the 12 red roses have to be, long-stemmed, etc., etc. Why does it need to be 12 red roses, etc.? It comes in different forms for different sentiments, for different days, for different moods, for different situations. And the manner of giving, the ceremony, the process may be different for each. What I'm trying to say is that just like there is a sort of language and a ritual of roses, which actually has nothing to do with flowers in general, but it really has to do with emotions. I'd like to claim that Korbanot, if we can get beyond the bloody aspect of it, the Korbanot actually has a similar language. Now again, those of us who are vegan are going to have a serious problem with using animals for any purpose, taking animal life. However, if we understand that in our contemporary world, a lot of people are meat eaters, and many people wear leather shoes and have leather jackets, etc., etc. It's clear that we feel that we can use animals for clothing and for industry. We can use animals for our culinary needs. It would be difficult to argue that we couldn't use animals for the purpose of religion. What exactly is the language of the Korbanot? So I'd like to start off with the Ola. The Ola is the first one to be mentioned. The first group that are mentioned in our Parashat Shavua are actually voluntary offerings. In other words, a person is moved religiously. They want to connect with God. They're a good Jew looking for greater spirituality, for a deeper meaning in their Judaism. And they want to connect somehow with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with God. How do they express their feelings? What flowers can they offer God? So actually there are two central options if we're talking about animal sacrifice. One is the Ola, and in the Ola, the animal is totally consumed on the altar. The animal slaughtered and totally burnt on the altar. And the other one is a Shelamim. Shelamim from the word Shalom, and that's very different actually. There the animal is slaughtered and the blood is put on the altar and the fat, but the animal is actually eaten by the person himself. Has to be eaten in Jerusalem, etc., etc., and we'll get to that. There are two totally different models of the korban. In one case, it's totally burnt, but in the other one, the people who bring it actually eat the entire animal. And therefore, what do these two things mean? Why are there two absolutely different tracks or two different ways of bringing korbanot? And what I'd like to suggest is that these two different korbanot suggest two very contrasting approaches to God, two very different mindsets, two different very different emotions. The Ola is totally consumed. It's given over in its entirety to God. The word Ola, of course, is from the word Ole. It means raised up, elevation. The Ola represents a very deep set of emotions. And I think what we'll have to say is that it actually represents something, the insignificance of man. Let me explain. One minute one sees a living, bleating animal, which is very much alive. And the next minute we see that it's absolutely reduced to nothing, to ashes. It reminds me of the prayer that we say on Yomim Noraim, where we talk about how we are like a broken pottery shard, a passing shadow, a fleeting dream. But God is the V'atahu melech el chai v'kayam. You, God, are the true king, the life source, the ever-existing being. The Ola represents a mood of man's insignificance and God's majesty, that really we are nothing. That God has enormous power which overwhelms and overpowers man, and sometimes that we are helpless and insignificant. There are times in life where we actually feel that. It's interesting that one of the moments in which somebody brought this particular sacrifice was Noah, when he came out of the ark. Noah comes out the Teva, and he actually brings olah. Why does he bring a korban olah? Maybe he feels so small in regard to all the titanic forces of nature which have been brought against him and destroyed the entire world. And he says, well, what is man after all? I don't know. Sometimes I also think that maybe he didn't want to bring a shlamim. He didn't want to eat of the animals he'd cared for an entire year. But olah is some expression on the one hand of God's ultimate power over life. That he is meimitu mechayeh. He can kill. He can give life. He is the ultimate power. And somehow it has to express the insignificance of life. The fact that we are here one day and gone tomorrow. We are ashes to ashes, dust to dust. This emotion, this awe, this emotion of awe-inspiring relationship to God, his grandeur, his power. Olah is an expression of absolute devotion to God. So that's one image. That's one whole world. Let's deal with the other one, shlamim. Shlamim, as I said, is from the word shalom, peace. It's actually eaten by the people who bring the korban in Jerusalem. And it is strange that we can have an offering to God which is actually eaten by human beings. So there's another word which is used to describe the shlamim. It's described many times as a zevach shlamim. You can look in chapter 3, that's where the shlamim is described. It's described as a zevach. And a zevach actually is a shared meal. We see that in many, many different places. A shared meal is a zevach, a feast of meat. It's a banquet between two parties. By the way, frequently a zevach happens when people are making a covenant of sorts. It's a banquet, a joint meal, where people are expressing their friendship, their kinship, their peace. If we could be so irreverent to describe it in this sense, what we'd say is that shlamim is a joint meal between man and God. Some of the animal, the blood, the life force, goes to God, but the rest of the animal is eaten by the human beings. God is inviting us to have the possibility of eating a meal together with him in his city in Jerusalem or in the courtyard of the temple. And therefore, it's got to represent a feeling of harmony with God, of a calm relationship, not this turbulent olah type relationship, but actually a sense of shalom, of peace with God. And we share this meal. And one of the fabulous situations that we have with a shlamim is that shlamim can be for situations of thanks. One of the classic shlamim is a korban todah. A korban todah is meant to be brought when a person is saved from illness, or when a person experiences some great happiness. And then people would all come to the temple, and they would bring with them their family and their friends, a group of who knows how many people, and they would bring a korban todah, which is a shlamim, a thank you expression. You know, nowadays when we celebrate a wedding, when we celebrate a bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, a brit milah, or some other ceremony, a milestone in life, it might even be a 80th birthday or something, and we're celebrating life. We invite friends frequently to a party, to a meal. The idea of a korban shlamim, of a korban todah, was that we wouldn't only share the experience with our friends, and we wouldn't only be able to share it with God by giving a devar Torah or something like that, but we actually could share it in a more tangible way, where the animal, even part of the animal, actually goes to the altar, is expressly given to God. What I'm really saying is that olah and shlamim represent absolutely different worlds. They have a different, whole different language. The olah represents the fear of God, man's insignificance in the face of God. The olah represents the fact that who is a human being anyway? We're here today, gone tomorrow. But the shlamim is actually when God invites us to his house to join him in a meal, where we have not a sense of yirat Hashem, fear of God, but love of God, where we express not man's insignificance, but man's significance. The fact that God wants a relationship with us, that God is willing to share with us. God wouldn't share with us if we were insignificant. Indeed, the shlamim, or the todah, represents our intimate relationship with God. God who is close at hand, God who is reachable, who has a presence in our lives. What I'm trying to say is that korbanot can really, would actually give the means of different modes of expression. A sin offering would help people to be able to deal with the negative sides of their life. And what was called a mincha, chapter 2 describes a mincha, which actually is a meal offering. It comes from flour and oil. It's not from an animal at all. And many people want to say that since most people's livelihood was in agriculture, the fact that one could bring from one's wheat and one's oil to God actually was a means of expressing either a request for prosperity or a thanks for a successful economic year. the idea that one could volunteer to bring a mincha, a meal offering from one's grain mixed with oil, in order to express something about one's livelihood, maybe a request for parnasa or thanks. What I'm trying to say is that the problem is that we look at sacrifices from the outside, and we find it very difficult to understand that there could be a whole language of significance, a rich dictionary of expressions which could be expressed through the different menu and the variety of the korbanot. But on the inside, the offerings were actually a very articulate way of being able to give something to God, and not give the thing that we were giving, but rather use those as a medium, a vehicle, to express our religious emotions, our heartfelt passions that we wanted to somehow communicate to the Almighty. Wish everybody a good week and a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.